Devlin. Pick of the week.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry on a very rainy Bondi beach in Sydney, Australia, and I'm joined by Adam Devlin in Melbourne. Hey, Adam, how are you doing?
G'day, Henry. I'm well. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm probably the only person who's Irish and not drinking alcohol. And, you know, by the way, happy St. Patrick's Day, Adam Devlin. Yes. Devlin.
You know, when we were in Ireland, before the Devlins moved to Australia, we were O'Devlins. We dropped the O off
really?
When we moved to Australia. Yes.
Wow, how interesting, because there's lots of Donovan. My surname is O'Donovan, dear listener, even though I rarely say that on the air. But there's lots of Donovans around, and they got rid of the O as well. And as the ex-president of the United States, when he went to Dublin, he said, you know, Obama, I'm really Irish. Just, you know, I didn't drop the O. Of course, yeah. Obama is not an Irish name. Yes. So you think you mentioned Ulster.
Yeah, that's the birthplace of the Devlin family. I'm not exactly sure where in Ulster. I know that there's a number of cities and regions in Ulster, but yeah, that's the origins of the Devlin name.
That's interesting stuff. I think everyone's got a bit of Irish in them, don't you know?
And we got our the Devlin family tree, the crest of arms, the coat of arms, because there was a Bishop Devlin, I think it was, who was actually the personal priest of the king.
Oh, very posh.
And he presented a coat of arms to the Devlin family because of their service to the king.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing. A long time ago, I'm guessing 1300s, 1400s?
Yeah, something like that. I'm really not sure. It was a very long time ago.
Okay, well, look, now you're here to do Pick of the Week, and before that, a poem. And just to explain to our listeners, Adam has been writing poetry for 30-plus years. Is that fair enough to say, Adam?
Oh, yes, easily.
It's just kind of funny, like, you know, I met you in 89 and the time has gone so fast, and you know, you were probably writing poetry poems in your teens in school.
I started writing poetry in high school. It was in year 8 and we were given an assignment to write poetry. We were in English, we were studying poetry. And my English teacher at the time, Isabel Robinson, who is an amazing English teacher.
I do believe she's a friend of mine on Facebook.
She certainly is.
Right.
She handed out this assignment where we had to write a piece of poetry on our own and bring it back to class. And so we all did this. We all handed it in. And she marked them all. And the next day she was handing them out. And she handed them all out except for mine. I didn't get mine back. And I was like, oh, what's going on here? And she said to me, Adam, when the lesson's over, I want you to just stay back. I need to talk to you about your poem.
Yes.
And I went, oh, shit. Yeah.
That's what I would have done too.
And so at the end of the lesson, everyone else left and I stood behind her and very nervously went up to her and I was like, yeah, what's wrong with my poem? And she said, just a couple of things. She said, first of all, who wrote it?
Oh.
And I went, I did. And she went, She said, I did some study. I did some research last night to see if I could find this poem anywhere, and I can't find it. I couldn't find it anywhere. So I'm just, you know, I don't believe you wrote it, is basically what she said to me.
Wow. What age are you?
I would have been 14, 15, something like that.
Okay.
And I went, I don't know what you mean. And she went, she said, this is really good. She said, your use of language, your use of the English language in this poem is very good. Mm. She said, what it's trying to say gets a bit lost in parts, she said. But she said, if you wrote this, then you have ability as a poet.
What a lovely thing to hear.
Yeah, and I said to her, well, I definitely wrote it. I said, I would never copy somebody else's work. Mm. And I didn't know the word plagiarise at that stage.
No, and of course, she had no Google to check that out.
And so she then said to me, did you enjoy the the assignment. And I said, yeah, I loved it. I said, I loved writing that. And she said, would you be happy to do some more? And I went, sure. And so she started sending me individual homework apart from the rest of the class,
wow.
Setting me little writing challenges to do.
Hmm.
And that continued for a couple of years that I had her as a teacher. And she really, I blame her for me writing poetry.
Well, look, it's a beautiful thing. Your poems are, you know, they deal with life in a very realistic sense. And that's a good thing. And very educational, actually, to me anyway. Now, what is this poem about? Because I like that you actually tell us what the poem's about before you recite it. That way people can sort of work out, you know, what's going on. Because sometimes I sort of go, what is he talking about? So let us know. This poem is called...
It's called Pasiphae. Mm-hmm. And I think that I could be wrong with the pronunciation of that. I've never actually heard the word spoken.
Yeah, I think you're right with the pronunciation. Pasiphae does sound about right to me.
Yeah. Now, Pasiphae in Greek mythology is the daughter of Perse and Helios, the sun god, and she's the sister of Aeetes, Circe, and Perses. She was the mother of Crete, and she mated and produced the Minotaur. She mated with a bull and with an artificial cow and produced an offspring which became known as the Minotaur.
Right.
So she's really all about lust and power and passion is the what Pasiphae is all about. And basically what it is about is coming to... like a lot of my early poetry, it's about coming to grips with who I was as a sexual being.
Yep.
You know, I've talked previously on here about my child sexual abuse.
Yes.
And then, you know, as puberty struck, you know, I started to realize that I was gay.
Mm.
And so being in a small country town, having been raped as a child, and then having... realizing that you're gay, not being able to tell anyone any of that.
Mm. What a lot of stuff to have to deal with as a teenager, as a teenager, you know?
Yeah. Mm. Yes. The only way I can say it is yes. There was
yes.
A lot there to unpack. I'm still unpacking at 55 years of age.
Yes, yes.
And probably will be forever, but that's okay. Mm. You know, you learn... With these sorts of trauma, you learn to
cope.
You learn to live with it because you never get over it.
Yeah.
Into.
Okay. So now I've read this, and is it hard? I'm finding it difficult. Despite everything you've said. Mm. What is the storyline in this?
Well, it's basically me looking at. Who I was both physically and spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to make sense of the insanity that I found myself in.
Right. Okay. Well, look, do you want to recite this for us now?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Pasiphae. The soul of a man cannot incur incarceration indefinitely. It needs a passage of indifference. I think of my soul as ice and my life is fire, slowly turning it to water that will seep from my very being. Once the fire and ice mix, I'll cease to be me, replaced by the shallow entombment of an eagle's mind. But who am I to question fate? I'm just a thought, a dream, shaken to existence by this cruel reality, shaped by this wicked wound that laughs at everything and knows no mercy. It'll take no prisoner from me. But then again, it may as well take this empty corpse, for I've no use of it anymore. Latent lust leaves me cold, and passion's a prehistoric premise long left extinct by modes of momentary madness. But if insanity is the beast, I wish it would feed on the prey laid at its feet. But it is not. It is something more, something to move the lines of injustification from tomorrow to today. Am I an unjustifiable excuse for this poorly posed portrait? I don't know. I just no longer know.
Gosh, was there any closure in it, when you penned this? Because I noticed that you say you don't know at the end, and you say it again. You just, you no longer know. Was there a sense of closure at all?
Not at the time when I wrote this, no.
Mm. And when did you actually write this?
I wrote this in 2009.
Right, so...
So I was out as a gay man, but I was not out as a survivor of child sexual abuse at that stage. I think I'd only told a couple of people at that point in my life that I had been abused as a child.
Mm.
One of which was you.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
But I think there was probably no more than four people I had told at this point in my life, and I didn't know what it meant to me at that point either. And this poem is one of those pieces that helped me make sense of it all.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, really there's no closure with this sort of thing.
No.
You can only just do as much as you can, I guess, to deal with it.
Yeah, and there's no easy solution. There's no easy path to getting to a point of acceptance and forgiveness with this sort of thing either. You just have to go through the hard work. You just have to, and that hard work is agony. You know, you've got to go through a lot of heartache and a lot of soul searching.
Sleepless nights.
Absolutely, and you get to points where you go, I don't want to be me anymore. I just can't do this anymore. And that there's a bit of that in this poem as well. So that's where it's at.
Okay. Well, look, now you're also here to do your Pick of the Week, which you've been doing for 11 years here on Bondi Tunes International Radio Network. And this is interesting because I love Bonnie Tyler.
She's amazing, isn't she?
I love her. And I just want to mention before we get into this, as you would know, she had a song called Believe in Me, which she sang in 2013 at the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yes.
And Britain, obviously.
And what a great song.
It was a great song. And it only came third in 2013 at the Eurovision Song Contest, which, I thought was a bit unfair. But that's the Eurovision Song Contest when they brought in voting by phone, which has completely corrupted the whole process. So, what are we talking about today? And tell me a bit about Bonnie Tyler. I believe she had in 1976, she had nodules removed from her larynx, I think. Like she had.
She did, yes.
And this proved to actually, some say, improve her voice.
Yeah, she had nodules removed from her voice, and she was told by her surgeon and her doctors that she had to not speak or sing for a period of time so that they could heal. And so she left her doctor's studio and went straight to a club and sang live.
Oh my god.
And that caused permanent damage to her vocal cords, hence the extra raspiness of her voice.
Yes.
Now I love her voice. I love the raspiness, the huskiness of her voice. So I'm in the camp that, her defying her doctors actually resulted in a better voice.
Yes. And of course, let's bear in mind, that was 1976. And I do believe her biggest song, it's gone out of my mind.
Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Thank you very much. I think that was 1979 or 1980 maybe. I can hear our listeners going...
It was actually 83, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
What a great song. What a great voice in that song, too.
But, of course, before then, she had a massive single in 1976 with Lost in France.
Oh, yes.
Which was a huge hit for her. And she followed that up in 1977 with her second biggest hit to date, It's a Heartache.
That's right, yeah.
It's a heartache. I promise never to sing again.
Please don't. So that was 78.
That was 77. Yeah.
77. See, I'm confusing the two songs there. That's why I said the other one. Okay. Huge hits.
Now, here in Australia, she's known predominantly for two songs. You've got Total Eclipse of the Heart, and from the soundtrack to Footloose is Holding Out for a Hero.
Oh, yes.
Both of those were huge hits here in Australia, and a lot of people think that she hasn't really done much more other than that, particularly here in Australia. But she's had a whole heap of other hit singles. She had in 1984, she had a huge hit with A Rockin' Good Way with Shaken Stevens.
Oh, yes. I remember that, yes.
Yeah.
Probably not released in Australia. Was that even really? I mean, I was in Europe.
It was a top 20 hit here.
Oh, okay.
Mm. In fact, that was a bigger hit here than Holding Out for a Hero was, although Holding Out for a Hero is much better known now in retrospection.
Mm.
And then she really hasn't had another hit in Australia since then. And so a lot of people think of her now as just a one or a two hit wonder.
But
however, she is, you may be surprised to hear this considering some of the other people that have come out of Wales, but she is the biggest selling Welsh recording artist of all time.
Gosh.
Okay. Bigger than even Tom Jones.
Well, that's big.
Yeah.
that guy's still going, and of course so is she.
Yeah. She's just released her 18th studio album.
Mm-hmm.
And she's to date released something like 82 or 83 singles, most of which have been hits for her in Europe. She's a perennial chart topper in Europe. She sells more records now in Europe than she does in any other market. And I'm excluding the UK from that as well. She sells more in Europe than she does in mainland than she does in England.
Is that right? That's interesting. Yeah.
Hmm. Still a reasonable recording artist in the UK. Her current album has gone top 20 in the UK, which is, you know, not to be sneezed at for you know, a woman of her age and at her point in her career. Not many people at her stage in their careers are still having hit albums. So, you know, she's defying the odds a lot with her career.
She's probably getting a lot of younger fans now who weren't born, you know, with songs like It's a Heartache. Getting new fans, yeah.
And, of course, Total Eclipse of the Heart gets used time and again. It's been used in many soundtrack films. It gets used in a lot of advertising. It gets played in every wedding you go to.
Oh, God, yes, of course it does.
you know, it's at every disco you go to. It's one of those songs that's just, it's constantly being played on the radio. It really is her signature tune now.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to her than just that song.
Yes, and she's still going, as we were saying. She's in her mid-60s, I do believe, at this point.
Let me just check her age. She's actually 69. So late.
Oh, really?
She'll turn 70 in June.
Wow. You see, that's kind of young in this day and age, isn't it? I mean, you know,
it is young in this day and age, but there aren't many 70-year-old women having hits.
No, and that's a very good point. It's similar to the acting world. You know, you keep on hearing about, you know, older female actresses having problems getting films, you know, being in films at their age, you know. It's the same sort of thing with singers, I imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, she's been written off so many times by the industry. They've gone, oh, well, this will be her last album. Oh, that was a hit. Oh, well, this next one will be her last album. Oh, that was a hit too. Oh, okay.
And it goes on.
Yeah. Her album, Rocks and Honey, which featured the single Believe in Me, which was the Eurovision song, was amazing. Like, that was in 2013, and it was one of my top albums of the year for 2013. And many people said, well, this is obviously where she'll bow out now. She'll take this the success of this album and she'll bow out on top. And of course, she's released a few albums since then, and all of them have been hits as well. So
good.
And
for
of course,
her.
Total Eclipse of the Heart, and It's a Heartache both sold well over 6 million copies as singles when they were released.
Yeah,
and both are considered among the best-selling singles of all time. So, you know, she's often overlooked, but when you're looking at any of the biggest-selling, most influential artists, recording artists of all time, if you're not putting Bonnie Tyler on that list, then you're not really serious about what you're talking about.
for sure. Okay, now this song is called Call Me Thunder. Just give us a rundown, and if you can present this for us, that would be great.
Absolutely. Her new album is called The Best Is Yet to Come. Now, if that isn't an ominous warning to her critics.
Indeed. Good for her.
Yeah, it's produced by David McKay, who has produced four of her albums to date. And they work really well together as producer and performer. Mm-hmm. She's got this album has a great collection of songs on it. Steve Womack, who is a very famous influential songwriter, he wrote one of the single releases on this, The Best Is Yet to Come, which is also, of course, the name of the album. He also wrote Stuck to My Guns and When the Lights Go Down, two other great tracks, as well as the song I'm going to play in a moment. Mm-hmm. She also does on this album, do you remember the song I'm Not in Love by 10cc from the mid-70s?
Yes, of course, yes.
Yep, by Eric Stewart and Graham Goldman.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing ballad, just beautiful song.
Yeah.
Very melodic, very sort of almost transcendental. She does a cover of that on this album. Now, she's still doing it as a ballad, but it's a rock ballad here with Bonnie Tyler.
Right.
She's reinvented that song, I'm Not in Love, and I strongly suggest if you like what I'm about to play, have a listen to her doing I'm Not in Love, because it's a work of beauty. But the song I'm going to do today is the song that's become very quickly my favourite on the album. It's a mid-tempo ballad, but it really has a rock sensibility to it. It is produced to put her voice at the very front and allow the music, the rock musicians behind her, to build her up.
Mm.
And it just, she has not sound this good in a very long time, I have to say. The album is, if you like rock music, and I have to say, rock music isn't my natural sort of thing I go to, but when it's done really well, I love it. And Bonnie Tyler doesn't get the credit she deserves as a rock musician because of Total Eclipse of the Heart. People listen to Total Eclipse of the Heart and she goes, she's a pop star.
Yeah, she's been put in a box, basically.
Yeah. But she's a true rock vocalist. She's up there with people like Pat Benatar, Suzy Quatro, you know, women who can really belt it out. And that's exactly what she does on this song. Lyrically, this song, it's a love song. The chorus goes, call me thunder in the morning, call me lightning through the night. Anytime you want me, I'm going to be there for you. And it'll be that way till the day I die. Call me thunder. I love it. So anyway, I'm just going to go straight into the song now. Here she is. It is the one and only, the incomparable Bonnie Tyler. Her new album is called The Best Is Yet to Come. And if she's sounding this good at this point in her career, you better believe her. The best is yet to come. But this is, to my ears, the best track on her new album. As I said, the album is called The Best Is Yet to Come. It's out now. The song is called Call Me Thunder. I love it. I think you'll love it. Take a listen.
Call me thunder. In the UK, Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Ching Hee Huan. She's the International Emmy-nominated TV chef and cookery author who has become ambassador for Chinese cooking around the world.
Hi, Ling.
How are you, Ching?
Thank you. I'm so well. Thank you. How are you? Gong Hei Fat Choi.
Very well. Gong Hei Fat Choi. Welcome to the show. I have watched your cooking program for many, many years when I was stuck at home with my young children. Now my daughter has become a mother and she loves your recipes.
Wow. Oh, thank you so much and congratulations.
I've got a little granddaughter now. I have covered a program to do with health and fitness quite recently to have you on the show. Just perfect timing. And Chinese food is so healthy. Teaching people how to cook Chinese food, demonstrate the cooking skills on television is wonderful. You're so friendly, you're so pretty, and you're still very young. How do you do it?
Oh, thank you so much. You're so sweet with all your kind words.
Thank you.
I don't know. How do I do it? I started young. Tiger parents, tiger mother and father. And they were like, you have to start when you're young. You have to work hard. And I think I started my food business when I was 21. Mm. This is almost like more than 20 years ago. So I that was my steep learning curve. And of course, even before that, I learned how to cook from my mother because she was away for work a lot and my father was a really bad cook, so I had to cook for him. So I learned when I was a teenager. I think most Chinese children do. They look over the shoulder, you know, when you're cooking and they observe and they learn. And I think that's the beauty is to start them young, you know, start learning about the heritage and about your anything, just any heritage that really, you know, that you're curious about. I think it's having this curiosity and learning about different cultures, and food is a way to do that. I think food connects everybody. So for me personally, it was learning how to cook Chinese food as well, because my parents are like, oh, you're going to be too Western. You need to come back and be more Eastern. And so that was a way, that was really my steep learning curve.
I was actually born in the mainland China during early part of my life, having tasted fantastic home cooking from my grandparents. I lived in Hong Kong and I tasted different food. They're all so special to me. I find cooking is an experiment. There's no rules about cooking. And if they taste good, healthy, as far as I'm concerned, that is a good dish. Do you find that?
Absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think the most important thing is just enjoying it. It is about experimenting and making it your own and not being too worried that it has to be X, Y, Z, you know, exactly. I think the main thing is just getting in the kitchen and making something healthy and delicious. I think my grandmother was, I don't know if your grandmother maybe, you know, would say to you, that, if you don't know how to cook, how can you be a decent human being?
Well, they say, if we can read, we can cook.
Right, there you go.
We're going to talk about your vegan new book in just a moment. You have left Hong Kong many years ago and you spent some time in South Africa with your family. And then you came to UK, you went to higher education, you studied at university. After graduation, you then picked up a walk. Did that come naturally for you?
Wow. So, yeah, so I'm an immigrant and my half my family in Hong Kong and half of them are in Taiwan. And I miss, you know, Hong Kong. I love the food in Hong Kong. You know, like you, I've traveled there many times and it's very different to the food that we sort of have here. But I think the takeaways in the restaurants are doing a good job here. You know, they create, in essence, the taste sort of home style dishes, but obviously ramped up a little bit in terms of flavor, really delicious. But home cooking is much more simplified, as you know, it's much more healthy. We tend to eat more vegetables at home, a little bit more balanced. It's not just meat, meat, meat. And so, you know, with my new cookbook, I wanted to celebrate that. And also to show people the variety of Asian dishes, help if you want to be more plant-based, because I think people are becoming more conscious, wanting to be more kinder to the planet, wanting to eat for health reasons. And actually, this book is really, I think it's got something for everyone. I hope so. Lots of recipes inspired by my travels, when we used to travel more freely, recipes that I used to cook for my family and friends, recipes that I learned on my travels in Hong Kong, master chefs in Hong Kong, where they cook on huge woks like this.
And clay pots. Do you remember clay pots?
Oh, clay pot cooking with warm comfort.
Tastes better.
Yes.
I remember a traditional recipe, very popular in the Far East, for mothers to eat after giving birth. It's a dish made with trotters and vinegar. Do you know what I mean? The one with the vinegar.
Yes, trotters and vinegar.
And that can only be cooked in a clay pot. If you cook it on a normal pot, it tastes sour.
Yes, that's true. There are lots of things like this, but you know how varied and how much depth there is. Culinary Chinese culture. So
yeah,
there is so much to be discovered and so much to be learned.
Food is so important. Like you say, food unites family, particularly during Chinese New Year. And as a child, I remember growing up, I was so excited. My mum would get us new outfit and new shoes to be the Chinese tradition. We would run around the whole village collecting lucky money. Those were the times, wasn't it? Those were the time we liked. So eating is a feast that unites people. Obviously, the food menu is essential. Do you find that having left Hong Kong for so long culturally, you're still very much in touch since your grandparents, they were in the farming business, I believe. Do you find that's never left you then?
Yes, both my grandparents are farmers, and so I grew up in rice paddy fields, fresh from the farm, and I love that sort of fresh farm to table eating and seasonal, and it's obviously in modern times slightly more trickier, but I think we're very blessed in this country. You know, in the UK, we've got lots of fresh produce, lots of ingredients we never used to have, actually. And now in the supermarkets, we've got an array of produce. And you can really recreate the flavors, the tastes, I think fairly quite easily. I mean, I would say, I mean, compared to, say, 20 years ago, when we couldn't have access to even things like fresh coriander. And now, there's no fresh coriander, we're like, what's going on?
Let's stop for a song called From Coast to Coast by Modern Talking. you have just tuned in, I'm talking with my guest, TV chef and cookery author, Ching Hee Huan. People even asking me, what is the difference between a dark soy and a light soy? And how to cook rice, they drain the water off. We don't drain water off. You know, when you stir it, the starch came out. Simple things like that. But with your cooking, demonstrating that on TV, you have helped millions of people across the world. You must have received many, many thank you for that.
Oh, thank you so much. It warms my heart to hear that. I hope so. I really do. I really hope people, you know, go online, check out the videos, learn something new, find something you love to eat, and they just try it. And I always say practice makes perfect. And I think the beauty of life, I think, you know, we can't, even in this crisis now, you know, the only thing is family and friends and good food.
Yes.
The most important thing. And health, of course, we must look after our health. You know, without that, we can't achieve anything, really, can we?
Exactly. I mean, look at the ingredients that using fresh organic ingredients in your cooking. But with a lot of people's budget, sometimes they find organic food a little bit too expensive.
You know, with the whole ethos of organic, I totally understand it is sometimes more expensive. Mm. I wanted people to really think about the question of organic. If we all farmed organically around the world, we could feed more people, actually. You know, if we if you grew some, and we grew some in any spare space that we had, actually the whole world could get by on an organic produce very easily. It's just that, you know, modern agricultural farming and all of that goes with that, it comes with, you know, that's not maybe so much more environmentally friendly, because there's a lot of us on the planet. So when I try and use organic, it's really to try and get people to start thinking about more holistic ways of eating in tune with nature. Goes a long way, using seasonal produce, using fresh where possible, to question, you know, an apple is an apple. Why is an apple organic, and then why isn't an apple inorganic, you know? Isn't an apple an apple? So it shows that we kind of moved away from the traditional ways of farming that my grandparents would have done, which everything was organic. I wanted people to think about that, because obviously, you know, nothing is more important than food and our respect for produce and planet. Together, if we... I believe that when people cook more, then they become much more aligned with who they intrinsically are, which is, you know, sentient. I think if you cook for yourself, you're showing yourself love. If you cook for other people, you're expressing your love. And if you decide to cook compassionately, then you're sharing love of all things.
In my personal experience, growing up eating Chinese food, meat features very heavily in most of our family meals. Did you find it easy finding meat substitutes that still give you vegan dishes that distinctive Asian flavor?
It was, I mean, meat substitutes, you know, age-old traditional Chinese, we use a lot of tofu. Soybean, you find that all across China, Hong Kong. The soybean makes delicious pastes and sauces, you know, make soy sauce. And tofu, actually, bean curd, has been featured on the ancestral, you know, plate for centuries. When we pray to our ancestors, we used to have dried meats, dried fish, dried oysters, dried scallops, and dried bean curd. So ever since, you know, for centuries, the Tang Dynasty, dried bean curd was up there as a revered ingredient. I think people forget that bean curd has been around for centuries, and it's not a new food.
Chinese people love tofu. They come in fry forms as well. You know, the soft one, they're better steamed. Do you agree? Are they better steamed?
Yes, the silken tofu, definitely steamed, or just cold. And then just pour a really delicious dressing over the top. I think the best way to treat silken tofu. But whichever way you decide to tofu, whichever way you decide to eat, I think the main thing is to find some inspiration and And once you enjoy the journey of cooking, I think you're on your way to becoming a rock star, like all the master chefs of Hong Kong, you know.
There are so many different brands of rice that are available. I get the Chinese fragrance rice. So do you think the differences in the rice that you can get in supermarket and the one that you can get in the Chinese store are very different in the taste and in the texture?
I think people are just discovering rice, you know, different kinds of rice, different kinds of noodles. But I think for this year, as long as you're going more, I think going more green is a great way to eat. Because I think traditionally you mentioned, you know, like we eat a lot of meat, and I think in fact too much meat. And when we do eat meat, you know, you use a little bit goes a long way. That, you know, I look to the ways of eating in the East, the traditional ways, and I look to being inspired. And I think at this time when things are limited and we can't travel, we can't see family and friends, I would go online, go to discoverhongkong.com/UK, look at videos to inspire. There's lots of chef videos, lots of new dishes, lots of sort of looking beyond the cooking, but actually looking at, you know, all these other areas, you know, of life, you know, for mental health, because it's not just, you know, we need to think about body, mind and soul and all these things. So it's really feeding our mind as well as literally feeding us physically. And I think as humans, we get too attached sometimes to that physical need. Remember, we're also non-physical. So we need to have the pleasure and relaxation of going away and, you know, having hope for the future, thinking about travel again, thinking about brighter days and holidays. And we need that to keep our genes and all our living cells, you know, happy as much as that bowl of delicious rice, you know.
I totally agree with your new cookbook called Asian Green. Does that incorporate soups as well? The Chinese people love making soup.
So in Asian Green, it's more around it about all across Asia. I take inspiration from lots of Cantonese inspired dishes from Hong Kong, lots of soups, lots of cleansing broths, salads as well. Fried dishes, noodles, the whole lot, and also desserts. And I'm not very good at making desserts.
My mum never seemed to make dessert for us, so we need to get your book. And you say, why cannot we cut noodles?
Oh, because noodles symbolize longevity, long life noodles. And when you're eating it, you know, noodles symbolize longevity, and you don't want to cut away your life.
I did eat duck on New Year's Day, and you mentioned duck symbolizes something.
Oh, duck is a symbol of fidelity, because Mandarin ducks mate for life. So, whether it's duck or fish, I wish you a very prosperous Chinese New Year.
Thank you. Are you continue to do more TV shows?
I really hope I do. I really, really hope. Yeah, fingers crossed. My agent's online, and she's... She's hoping that, you know, she's going to keep me busy. I was just on Saturday Kitchen last weekend, and I think the Lorraine video went out last week as well.
How do we get hold of your book? Amazon?
Yes, please. Amazon, or you can go to Waterstones. I've got signed copies of the books there.
Thank you so much, Chin, for coming to my show.
Oh, thank you so much, Ling. And you have Gong Hei Fat Choi.
Gong Hei Fat Choi. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. This is Lin Pang for Bond 9 Tunes International, and I talked with Ching He Huan.
question, are you out or your angles? If you roll, you roll with the real thing.
Searching for the real thing.
Do this, do this.
Come on, come on.
Do this, do this.
It's a Broadway melody. A Little Night Music is a show with music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, with a plot inspired by the Ingmar Bergman film Smiles of a Summer Night. It made its debut on Broadway in 1973. The song Send in the Clowns, written for and sung by British actress Glynis Johns, who starred along with fellow Britisher Hermione Gingold, became popular with theater audiences, but had not become a pop hit. Sondheim explained how the song became one. First of all, he said, it wasn't a hit for 2 years. I mean, the first person to sing it was Bobby Short, who happened to see the show in Boston, and it was exactly his kind of song. He's a cabaret entertainer. And then my memory is that Judy Collins picked it up, but she recorded it in England. Frank Sinatra heard it and recorded it, and between the two of them, they made it a hit. In 1975, Judy Collins did record Send in the Clowns and included it in her album Judith. The song was released as a single, which soon became a major pop hit. It remained on the Billboard Hot 100 for 11 weeks in 1975, reaching number 36. Then in 1977, the song again reached the Billboard Hot 100, where it remained for 16 weeks and reached number 19. At the Grammy Awards of 1976, the Judy Collins performance of the song was named Song of the Year. So, send in Judy Collins.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clouds. Isn't it? Where are the clouds? again with my usual flair, sure of my lines, no one is there. Don't you love a farce? My fault, I fear. That you'd want what I want. Sorry, my dear, but where are the clowns? Quick, send in the clowns. Don't bother, isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. But where are the clowns? There ought to be clowns.
And thank you for joining us here on Bodai Tunes International. My name's Henry. I live on Bodai Beach in Sydney, Australia. See you next week.
Henry O'Donovan.